This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Enterprise Biz Bytes. I'm Roshan Kanisan, joined in the studio by
Frida Liu.
It is now 5 minutes past 12 p.m., Monday, March 27th. And today we're going to be talking about Menurama and the unintended consequences of government in business. You know, your breezy lunchtime conversation, Frida.
Well, for those who are having lunch.
Yes. Of course, my apologies. Now, the initiative, of course, was launched by the Domestic Trade and Cost of Living Ministry of KOKB. Around 2 months ago to help provide affordable meals during a time of increasing cost of living. And while beneficial to many consumers, has the initiative been harmful to smaller F&B businesses and disrupted the livelihoods of small traders? Let us know what you think over on WhatsApp at our U-Mobile number 018-789-8899. Once again, that is 018-789-8899. So today, we're exploring this on Enterprise Biz Bytes. First, we'll be speaking with F&B operator Nazri Adam from Associate Sizzle to give us a bit of a perspective from the proprietor in the business. And then we'll take an economic view with economist Dr. Jeffrey Williams from the Malaysia University of Science and Technology to get his perspective on why he thinks Menurama is harmful from an economic perspective. Now, before we speak to Nazri first, Frida, let's take a quick primer of the situation.
Right. So the Menurama initiative was launched by the Domestic Trade and Cost of Living Ministry, KPDN, around 2 months ago, January 31st. Participating restaurants have been offering meals which consist of a plate of rice, chicken and fish, and vegetables priced at no more than 5 ringgit. However, there have been criticisms of the initiative from small food operators. President of the Bumiputra Petty Traders Association, Dato Sri Rosli Sulaiman, told NST in early February that some small traders have lost profits operating in the same food court as stalls supplying the menu, adding that some operators reported considerable losses in the first week of the launch of the menu. So for context, the association president added that with the price of chicken at 9 ringgit 30 cent per kilogram at a time, it would cost 4 ringgit per part if you cut the chicken into 12 pieces. And once you add rice and a drink, this would go above 5 ringgit, leading to a loss from the operator.
Yeah, so the NST also spoke to a mixed rice stall operator in Bangsa. I wonder whether this is around Balai Burrito, of course, who told them that she was operating at the time, given that the competition from the Menurama with a bit of challenges during that time. She added that as the cost of food increased, she had to charge 8 ringgit for the same menu. So she saw her own cost having to go up.
Right. Even Maidin, which was one of the earliest to take part in the initiative, warned a month ago that the chain will only be able to run the initiative for 3 months if the price of raw ingredients kept increasing.
So we dive into the impact of Menurama on the F&B industry and the unintended consequences of government in business. With our first guest today, Nazri Adam, the founder and co-owner of Sausage Sizzle, which has around 10 outlets currently, 9 of which are roadside stalls. Nazri, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Roshan. Thank you so much, Frida. Thanks so much for having us on board on behalf of Sausage Sizzle today. Really appreciate that.
So first thing, Nazri, your business isn't taking part in the Menurama initiative. Give us a sense of why.
It isn't because I think, obviously, you know, we are running a primarily licensing-based operation, which means that we have licensees who are taking products from us at fixed costs and they have to follow at fixed retail prices to maintain a margin. If we were to bring down the retail price of our products to the 5 ringgit mark...
Which kind of like sort of leads me to how realistic is it to provide a meal which includes a rice, a protein, a portion of vegetables and a drink for 5 ringgit?
Okay, to be honest with you, Frida, at this point in time, it's really unrealistic. You know, I mean, if you mentioned just now with regards to you cut a chicken into 12 pieces, one piece is 4 ringgit. In food and beverage right now, let's just talk about in general, a healthy food cost margin would be roughly 30%. So if you are selling Menurama, which is, you know, it's supposed to be 5 ringgit, that means your food cost should be around the 1 ringgit 50 mark. So if you, if you're to sell 1.50 ringgit, but your chicken costs 4 ringgit, then it's going to be a little bit difficult. Yeah, so very unsustainable at this point in time.
Right. Yeah. So as we were getting into it, right, some roadside food stalls have said that the initiative has hurt their business because the bigger fast food players are muscling in on their price points and taking the associated loss to benefit from marketing, or maybe because they're such high volume players, they have better margins in the first place. Is this in line with your own experience or what you've heard on the ground?
Well, I can't really speak for obviously those who are operating, you know, doing the menu rahma, because we are not involved in it at this point in time. But I can imagine with such competition and with such more small margins, I mean, obviously, if you're going to sell something at 5 ringgit and your margin is cut to a very minute percentage, then you need to focus on volume.
Right.
But if you're not able to focus on volume because of the heavy competition, then it makes it extremely difficult. So I guess, having the introduction of fast food players, or not really controlling the who is offering the menu rahma and where it's being offered and all these things, I think it's...
Right.
Is making it really difficult.
And small food operators are not playing the volume game. I mean...
Exactly, right? Exactly.
And yeah. It just makes you wonder, you know, with this kind of profit margins, if at all, right, what's the point of doing this? Now, have you heard, though, of small businesses that have closed up shop because they can't compete with the menu rahma?
I think at this point in time, those who have closed, not so much, but those who have opted out of the, offering of the menu rahma, so many.
So do you know people in the business who initially opted in because maybe of a marketing push or something, and then later, like, this is not sustainable for us?
At this point in time, to be honest with you, no. I don't know any who are, you know, offering rice and chicken and all these things at this point in time. But I do know of larger players or fast food restaurants who are offering, who are still, you know. But if you look at, for example, Tea Life or any of the other bigger brands, big chains in the country, it's all limited time only. So from maybe 1st of March to 1st of February to 28th of February only, we're offering this drink at 5 ringgit. So that shows you it's definitely a marketing tool.
I'm sure terms and conditions apply, maybe the first 1,000 or something.
Most definitely, yeah.
So we're going to take a much larger economic view or perspective in a bit, but as an F&B operator yourself, what do you feel would be more helpful ways to address all these ingredient costs concerns, right? There have been a lot of them, prices have gone up, menu rahma was seen as a way to, you know, help the consumer, maybe unsustainably, possibly, probably. So talk to us about how you feel would be more helpful ways.
Well, obviously, at this time, everyone is talking about cost because the retail price has already been set by the government, right, at 5 ringgit. So if we are unable to control the cost of the product, then that's going to end up with a lot of, you know, the issues that we're facing at the moment with regards to menu rahma, right? So I think from the government's perspective, if they were able to offer a targeted subsidy that is controlled and structured, then possibly it would make it easier for F&B operators to, move on with an initiative like this or get onto the bandwagon. Basically, yeah. So, yeah.
All right. Azri, don't go anywhere. We'll be back in just a bit. Up next, economist Dr. Jeffrey Williams enters the chat, and we'll be getting into why he thinks menu rahma is harmful from an economic perspective. In the meantime, tell us what you think over on WhatsApp at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Right now, here is the 1975 with She's American. I'm Roshan Karnison. Keep it at BFM 89.9.
Balanced Frank Medium, BFM 89.9.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Enterprise Biz Bites. I'm Roshan Karnison, joined by Frida Liu in the studio this afternoon. If you've just joined us today on Biz Bites, we've been exploring the impact or potential impact of menu rahma on the F&B industry and the unintended consequences that come from the government being in business. Very, very light and breezy conversation this afternoon. We've been speaking with...
lovely Monday.
It's just a lovely Monday. Yes. You know, Monday blues, what better way to talk about government in business? So we've been speaking with Nazri Adam, who's the founder and co-owner of Sausage Sizzle, to give us a perspective from an F&B proprietor's perspective. And now joining us in the studio is economist Dr. Jeffrey Williams from the Malaysia University of Science and Technology, so that we can tap into the larger economic perspective as well. Jeffrey, welcome to the studio.
fantastic to be here, see you face to face.
In the flesh.
Yes, in the flesh. Yes.
So, Jeffrey, before we get into the possible harm from the initiative, as an economist and a professor, could you give us a little bit of a brief primer into the factors that lead into the increases in cost of living, right? Because this is, we talk about it a lot. It's a term that's thrown a lot, but no one really explains what goes into it, right?
Okay, so there are basically two elements to it. One, of course, is higher prices. But the other side of it is income. Mm-hmm. Because really, when we talk about cost of living, we're talking about affordability.
Right.
So if your income goes up and prices are going up, you're not really any worse off relatively. But the big problem arises because prices have been going up and people's income has not been following, particularly those in lower income groups. And that means that the prices rise and the products go out of their reach.
Right.
Or they have to start giving up some things in order to maintain the essentials in life. And that's what the real problem is in terms of cost of living.
Right. And of course, cost of living is a pressing issue. And you contend that Menurama is harmful as it crowds out small traders and causes more problems than they solve. So break this down for us.
All right. So let's just be clear. We all are concerned about the cost of living, mm-hmm. particularly on people in lower income groups. It's very important. It really is. And we've had it for a long time now, all the way through the lockdown and even now. And it looks like it's going to go on into the future. So anything that people are suggesting, we have to look at seriously. So I believe it's a well-intentioned attempt to try to help people. But the problem is it doesn't take into account the economy as a system. And what it's basically doing is taking a segment in the food market and fixing the upper price. And the people who are currently selling in that segment are actually low-income food providers themselves,
right.
The low-income group people themselves. And often, they only do it for a short period. They will come out in the morning for breakfast time.
Yeah.
They will then get a full-time job, do something else. Then they come back in the evening, and it's a part-time job for them to uplift their salaries overall. The big players don't entertain this sector, generally speaking, because it's of no value to them in terms of costs and in terms of sales and so on. So under the current system, people all get a share of it. And those who want to sell at this low price can find sales, and they don't have a big volume, but they make some money.
Right.
Now, the problem with the Menurama scheme is that suddenly someone who's selling a burger at 6 ringgit looks expensive, because now there's a food option at 5 ringgit. And at 6 ringgit, actually, he's not making any money at all. It's probably 2 ringgit for his costs, 2 ringgit to pay his staff, and then 2 ringgit in terms of profit. Now, suddenly, his profit has gone down by a ringgit, and that's a lot. So when you work this out, I did some brief calculations. So they wanted to have 15,000 people or 15,000 food outlets in this scheme over. That was the target. And I worked out that if they lose a ringgit on each of the plates that they sell, and they're only selling 20 plates a day, every day for 365 days, the total loss would be 109 million ringgit to the industry as a whole. And that's just a tiny segment of it. And so there's a massive loss to that group of people. And remember, these are low-income people as well, B40 and even below B40 people. And what that means is suddenly they're just about making ends meet at 6 ringgit. Then suddenly they have to sell at 5 ringgit, and they can't make ends meet at 5 ringgit. So what do? They close.
Right. Jens, we're going to go into a few messages very quickly, and we'll be back to continue to break down this complex topic. We've been speaking with Nazri Adam, the founder of Sausage Sizzle, as well as Jeffrey Williams, economist with the Malaysia University of Science and Technology. We'll be back in a few minutes. Right now, here's Chain of Fools by Aretha Franklin on BFM 89.9.
Birkins for Mama. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Enterprise Biz Bytes. I'm Roshan Kanesan, joined in the studio by Frida Liu. Now, if you've just joined us today on Biz Bytes, we've been exploring the impact of Menurama on the F&B industry and the possible unintended consequences of government in business. We've been speaking with Nazri Adam, the founder of Sausage Sizzle, to give us a perspective from the F&B operator side of things, but also to get the larger economic perspective. We've been speaking with economist Dr. Jeffrey Williams from the Malaysia University of Science and Technology. Gentlemen, thanks for sticking with us here. So, Jeffrey, over to you. So the minister in charge, Dato' Sri Salahuddin Ayub, the domestic trade and cost of living minister, said last week that concerns of restaurants closing down from offering Manurama were, as he said, unfounded, saying that the risk of them suddenly losing profits to the point they needed to close is extremely unlikely, as they reduced as the reduced profits from selling Manurama is made up by the increased number of new customers due to rent Manurama. I was quoting him there, as per the Star. Now, doesn't the minister make a good point here in the sense that a business can be built on volume and small margins?
Well, the question is, what data does he have to support this?
Mm.
Because there isn't a great deal of data. We have a lot of anecdotal data. We have a lot of social media evidence that companies are, or these small firms are really struggling. And the ministry really needs to have proper data on this. Many of these outlets are guys who sell at the side of the road.
Right.
So actually they're not being monitored. And you know that during the lockdown, there was a lot of liberalization of that and people were allowed to put up wherever they wish. And so we don't actually know whether they're closing down or whether they're not closing down. Now, in terms of the increased volume of sales, again, there's no evidence that there are extra people going, buying extra food. In fact, part of the whole process is not to buy the more expensive food, but to buy the cheaper food. So you're not actually buying more food. You're buying the same amount at a lower price.
Right.
So you're not getting an increase in the volume.
Actually, Nazri, I would be curious to hear your perspective on this as well. Because the F&B, I think you were talking earlier about the generally accepted margin for F&B being around 30% there.
That's correct, yeah.
And the minister, what he's trying to say here is basically you can make up the money with volume, right? But that's not how all F&B operators operate, do they?
Look, the majority of F&B operators, if you want to hit volume, you're going to have to do some sort of marketing because awareness equals to sales, right? So if you don't have the budget for marketing because your margin is being taken up by the cost of goods, then it's not that easy. It's like one in maybe 1,000 F&B operators that operate on the road stall get lucky enough to be covered by one of these the food bloggers or whatever like that,
right,
that really, really significantly helps the customers. But to be honest with you, even these food bloggers, when they come over, it's not guaranteed. It is not guaranteed, so it's very, very rare at this point in time.
Speaking of marketing, right, Dr. Williams, you know, big franchises have joined the Manurama campaign in a big way, but given that they're either losing money or on this or making less profit, even if they justify it as a marketing tool, how long do you think they can keep, you know, this going for?
Actually, on one hand, they can keep it going forever because they can just put it on their menu and whether they sell it or not, it doesn't matter to them. That's the issue. I think in many instances, what they're doing, there is a question as to, you know, whether they are actively trying to take over this space. I don't think they are because it just doesn't make any sense for them, or whether they want to help the ministry promote this process, because without them, the number of outlets would be very small. I mean, up to the middle of March, there were only about 1,000 restaurants, 1,000 companies that were involved in it. Then you have these big names. Now we estimate it's about 2,500, something like that. But it's still very close from the 15,000. So perhaps they're just there to try to help out. But the truth of it is, they're not really interested. And if they were left, well, we know this because before they had this scheme, they weren't in that space. So they were never interested in it before. So they would put it on their menu and keep it there. Whether they sell it or not is neither here nor there for them.
We were talking about volumes earlier, right? So, but unlike the small traders, the big franchises and the big F&B players, they have volume, which in turn gives them leverage when negotiating with suppliers, or they have a big control of the supply chain, which helps them again manage those costs better, which means they have larger margins and they're able to manage Manurama's business impact a bit well, whether they price it into their marketing efforts or they just take a smaller cut off the pie while tapping into the marketing potential there. And Nazri, you were saying earlier that the small traders can't really market out there, but you see the bigger ones marketing it. So they're getting that goodwill, they're getting their marketing potential there. Jeffrey, when we know kind of what's happening here, and we know that it's impacting them. Give us a sense of what you think the potential longer term risks could be if they can keep going on like this, we could see small traders and smaller businesses be even more impacted.
Well, I mean, if they find that actually it is having an effect because they're just trying it out at the moment. So let's say they're trying it out and they find it is having an effect. People are coming in for the cheap menu and then actually buying something else, and then they're making some money out of that. They might decide that it's actually there's some space for them there and they want to stay into the market. Yeah. But the other issue, of course, is in the meantime, while they're testing out the market with this menu, in the meantime, all of these small players are going out of business. And when they go out of business, the chances are they're going to stay closed because they will then have to reinvest and restart from scratch. And that means, and they won't have that because they'll go out of business and lose their income. How are they going to rebuild?
You know, you wrote on FMT that you do not solve the crushing problems of abject poverty with cheap meals and fast food outlets. The structural reforms are necessary. I'm going to quote you. And the solution must focus on raising incomes for those most in need. So without doubt, it's a complex topic. But where should the government be focusing its efforts in order to start addressing the cost of living issues from a more sustainable perspective? So give us an economics lesson right now.
I was scolded, you know, I said, you don't solve this problem with a government subsidized egg sandwich and leftover salad. And someone scolded me for that. Well, never mind, I deserve it. So, but the thing is, you can't address the question of cost of living, affordability, and particularly the question of abject poverty, because that's what this was originally targeted at, the 127,000 hardcore poor families. That was really where it was targeted to begin with, and it suddenly morphed into something that's not that. You can't deal with that by controlling prices and trying to keep prices down for these groups, because it's an unending problem and it will distort the market. And that's what we're talking about.
Right.
We're
exactly.
talking market distortion. Last week, you guys had the Brazilian ambassador here, and he talked about a scheme they have in Brazil, which is called Bolsa Família. And Bolsa Família is a conditional cash transfer program. And he mentioned that they had been able to bring out of poverty 40 million people. And he pointed out this is more than people, more than there are people in Malaysia, 33 million. But he said it's about the size of Spain.
Wow.
So that type of conditional cash transfer program is definitely, for sure, demonstrably much more successful at addressing the issue of hardcore poverty and extreme intergenerational poverty than trying to fix prices. It's a universal basic income, which you talked about 1,000 times. But the government has such a scheme, but they haven't restructured it in the way that they're not giving it to people on a systematic monthly basis. They're still giving it, you know, ahead of Raya, ahead of Chinese New Year in blocks rather than in a structured way. And that's the way to solve hardcore poverty.
It oftentimes feels like, so we understand that income is the issue, and yes, okay, your cash transfer, however you want to call it, whatever name you're using, is one of the better ways to do so, because then you put hands in people's money in people's hands for them to use as they deem fit. Now, the thing is, the government, maybe that takes a bit more time and it's not as flashy as you would want during a time where the headlines are all about cost of living. So you do something like Manurama or something else or the other that kind of gets more attention, rightly or wrongly. So that sometimes there feels that there's too many programs going on, and all these programs cost money that could actually be consolidated into a cash transfer program.
Yes.
Dr. Williams, give us a sense of, there are many different things the government is doing out there. Would it just be better to just focus on cash transfers in that sense?
Yes, in my view, it would. And it would be very much cheaper. You know, last year they spent $80 billion on subsidies, and I estimated that if they had a conditional cash transfer scheme or universal basic income scheme, it would cost $20 billion, one quarter of what they spent last year. But you're also right, because there are so many different schemes. And often what happens is people don't realize that they're eligible for one scheme, or they have to go from one department to another department, the Zakat or the local council or the state level or the federal level. And then they fall out of it because they're not completely familiar with what's available to them. But the other thing about a conditional cash transfer is there's no middlemen. Goes directly from the finance ministry into your bank account. And that's, in my view, one of the reasons why there is resistance to a cash transfer scheme. Because whenever there's a program, whenever there's a scheme, whenever there's a permit to be issued, there's opportunity for wastage and leakage. But when you have a cash transfer, there's no opportunity for wastage and leakage. It goes directly from the finance ministry directly into your bank account or into your MyCard or however you want to receive it. You can, if you want to receive it in cash, you can have it in cash.
I like the terminology, wastage and leakage.
Well, there's a euphemism, I think.
Okay. I know you've talked a lot about this, right? You know, I guess what would you tell policymakers to do? Generally, right? Before introducing initiatives like MenuRound, I mean, you've given some examples. Well, what would your advice be?
So we know every year we have the Auditor General report telling us about the wastage and leakages, but that's always after the fact, right? And we know for sure it's happening all the time. We know it. And wouldn't it be good if we actually worked it out before it happened?
Yes.
So this scheme, the MenuRound scheme, where did it come from? Who designed it? Was it put in front of a group of economists and F&B experts to look at it and say, from an F&B expert perspective, I've been doing this for 20 years and this is never going to work? Right. And economists saying, actually, you know what? This is going to cause more harm than good. Mm-hmm. Was it actually exposed to independent assessment before it came?
Right.
Because it was very quick, right? Yes. Remember, right? And nobody knew where it came from and nobody knew before it was announced. And then it went to Parliament, but even the politicians were sort of taken by surprise.
Right. So something like this up front, discussed with all the parties, relevant bodies, and then said that this was already discussed with all these bodies, and this is what we came up with, rather than surprise.
Because, you see, they said that they discussed it with the F&B associations.
Right.
And that's where the 15,000 potential F&B outlets came from. They said, yes, all of our members will love this. Mm-hmm. But then suddenly they didn't turn up, these F&B outlets. So did they discuss it with the F&B associations? And what was the input from the F&B associations? And the other big problem is, it's such a lovely scheme, the way it's presented. Nobody wants to criticize because you really look like a Grinch. I mean, I get all sorts of trolls telling me you're a real Grinch for not liking this scheme. Yeah, but it's not because I'm not a Grinch. It's not because I'm a Grinch. It's because I really genuinely think it's causing more harm than good from an economics perspective. And we can solve that by looking at it in advance.
Yeah. So where it came from, sometimes you wonder whether the people they spoke to were not aware of the fact that the government wouldn't be putting any money into it, right? Maybe there was a miscommunication and you said, oh, we want to do MenuRama at 5 ringgit a plate. This is what we want to do. Mm. Are you in? And then maybe they're thinking, oh, yeah, sure. I mean, if you give us some money to do it, we'll do it, you know? But that's a whole different conversation and it requires engagement. Nazri, as we wrap up the conversation, maybe give us a sense of, I know we talked about this a little bit earlier, but based on what Jeffrey has said as well, what would you like to see from the government as a proprietor in the space? And there's a lot of this also going on because obviously we're going to state elections in a few months' time. Maybe the reason why they wanted to rush this out was to get a bit of goodwill. But long term, you're a business person. Yeah. You want to be here in long term. You need to make money. What would you like to see the government do to better improve the F&B operator space?
Exactly. I mean, I think at this point in time, this MenuRama thing is this initiative is a very consumer-focused initiative. So the consumers definitely benefit from it, which is, linked to what you talk about with being the Grinch when you don't, you're not so accepting of it, right? So I think that it's important to for the government to, when they release initiatives like this, to think about it from both sides, from the consumer's side and also the F&B operator's perspective as well. And I think that they left out the F&B operator's perspective in this sense. I think personally, maybe they should have worked with, if they really want to roll something like this out, they should have worked with bigger corporations who have a larger reach, who are able to tank some of the costs. For example, huge chain supermarkets, for example, maybe Lotus or people like that, to provide them with a little bit of subsidies, controlled subsidies, and then potentially, divert customers to Lotuses if you want to have the MenuRama between a certain time of the day, certain time to certain time, to lift the weight of the competition for the roadside stalls and things like this, controlled area, controlled space, structured in that sense. I think that maybe would have helped out a little bit to relieve some of the pressure from F&B operators, for example, you know, something along those lines.
All right. And Jeffrey, before we wrap up, any parting notes?
I think I've said enough. I won't be able to come back on. I'm definitely not going to get an egg sandwich from you guys.
Nazir, Jeffrey, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was Nazir Adam, founder of Sausage Sizzle, and economist Dr. Jeffrey Williams from the Malaysia University of Science and Technology. If you miss any part of that conversation, you can catch the podcast on our website at bfm.my or download the BFM app. You can also find our shows on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and all the other major podcast players. Just search for BFM Enterprise Biz Bites. After the 1 p.m. news bulletin, we've got the Breakfast Grill replay, and on the hot seat this morning was Datin Mina Che Fong, the managing director of In Nature Berhad, which is the franchisee for the Body Shop in Malaysia, Vietnam, and Cambodia. Now, thanks to recovery in spending, the group recorded its highest top-line growth in 7 years for the financial year of 2022. In Nature also became the first B Corp certified public listed company in Southeast Asia. So the managing director joins Shazana Mukta to get into the process of receiving the certification, their disposal of Natura, which was a promising area a few years back, and the outlook for the beauty industry. Catch that after the 1 p.m. news bulletin. I'm Roshan Ganesan with Frida Liu, and this has been Enterprise Biz Bites. Taking you up to the 1 p.m. news bulletins, we've got the Undertones with Teenage Kicks. Keep it here to BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.